Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Powerful Patient, as we have interesting conversations with people involved in all kinds of care and all kinds of research and all kinds of advocacy for patients. And we're going to have the same thing going on in the background as we did before, so we may replay this thing and do it again.
The tech specs are always exciting, Mike.
Always. I love it. We know how to edit that stuff out, though.
Right. I'll say it now.
That thing's got to echo. We'll have to come up with it. So I'll start over again, and we'll play the music and go to this end. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Powerful Patient, as we have interesting conversation with folks of interest. Joyce, it's good to have you with us on the call today. I'm glad you're co-hosting this program with us.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be with you, as always.
And we also have Robin Martinez on with us. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Mike. I'm taking a little break from smartpatients.com to talk to a fantastic scientist.
Yes, you really are. We have somebody lined up that I think our listeners will get a lot of information from. I've had the privilege of knowing this fellow for about a year and a half, and he is quite a motivator to me and quite an inspiration. So we'd like to welcome to the podcast today. His full name we won't get into. We'll just call him Al Copeland from the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Al. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Glad to be with you and Joyce and Robin today. It's a privilege.
Well, we're glad that you're with us. And Al, I know that your lab has quite a daunting title. The Cancer Biology and Translational Oncogenics Lab. And how did you get involved in cancer research?
Well, the true story, it was an accident. I'm actually trained as a reproductive endocrinologist and had made a discovery of a compound that I was working with and accidentally discovered that it had anti-tumor or anti-cancer activity. And so being the scientist that I am, I started doing research and slowly converted to cancer biology research and have just fallen in love and very passionate about discovering new cancer genes that play a role in tumor development. And that's kind of where this long title comes from, this translational oncogenomics, is that we take patient tumor tissues and compare their gene expression in say the normal kidney versus that of the patient's kidney tumor tissue, and we've identified numerous oncogenes or genes that cause cancer and also tumor suppressor genes that are silenced in the tumor and that prevent cancer, and some of those genes we're following up on and trying to develop novel therapies as well.
And you basically deal with renal, thyroid, and breast cancers in your lab. Is that correct, or do you work with other cancers also?
We do work with other cancers as well. We a little bit of everything, believe it or not. So we published in just about almost every solid tumor.
Well, go ahead, Robin.
I understand what oncogenomics means. It's the genes that have to do with cancer, either promoting it or squelching it. But what exactly is translational research?
Translational is where you actually move your discoveries in the laboratory to the clinic. And so we've made discoveries that have actually gone to clinical trials in thyroid cancer and And we've actually developing a new small molecule inhibitor that we discovered in kidney cancer that this gene called sterol CoA desaturase 1 or SCD1 is highly overexpressed in aggressive kidney cancers. And we've come up with a small molecule that blocks this signaling pathway. And so we're developing this compound as we speak to try to get an investigation of a new drug, FDA approval, and hopefully to get it into clinical trials.
Now that's SAD, not...
No, FDA, Food and Drug Administration.
But the drug you're talking, the sorry, oh, elements
oh,
you're
the
talking
target.
About is SCD1,
yeah.
Right?
Correct, SCD1,
okay.
Sterol CoA desaturase 1, yes. It's the
yeah,
rate limiting.
At first it sounded like S81, and I thought,
sorry.
That's not it. That's okay.
No.
You're
right.
With it, so.
Yes, it's the rate limiting enzyme that converts saturated fatty acids to monounsaturated fatty acids, and interestingly, aggressive cancers in general. So we found that this is actually a general phenomena and not limited just to kidney cancer. And so cancer cells that replicate rapidly rely on this pathway and upregulate it to make these monounsaturated fatty acids, which are essentially lipids that are another energy source for cancer cells other than glucose. And also the monounsaturated fatty acids are incorporated into the cell membrane. And so it appears to be a target generally overexpressed in cancers that are aggressive.
That's great.
The cell wall is an interesting thing because it holds all these different receptors, but the cell wall itself is very important to the survival of the cancer cell, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And as you said, there are receptors that many of these tyrosine kinase receptors that integrate into the cell membrane or the cell outer cell wall are mutated, and when they're constitutively turned on, they are signaling all the time, telling the cell to grow, and replicate. And essentially, that's what cancer is. It's genetic mutations or epigenetic alterations that tell cells to continually replicate. One cell becomes two cells become four become eight. And so if you've got cells replicating every day, and cancer cells can do that, you know, you can have millions of cells within 30 days, 5 to 6 million, 50 to 60 million cells within 30 days just from one cell.
Oh my
so
goodness.
You can, oh yeah, so you can clearly understand that if, you know, a good friend of yours has an aggressively growing cancer and it's metastasized to the liver or to the brain or to the bone, how these cells can, you know, continually replicate, take over the organ and shut it down, and your friend is dead within
yeah.
months because of these very aggressive cancers.
Right. So we've got a lot of big words here, and I know many of our listeners are going to feel a little bit lost, but they're very important because the way that the body sort of sends signals to the various cells is through these enzymes and compounds that you're talking about with these funny long names. But one tells another one, it's time to divide to become more cells or to slow down. And understanding how these relationships work is really key to controlling cancer. And so the work you're doing is extremely important. So cancer is partly about growth and partly about what we call metastasis, or the ability to spread, to plant itself in some other organ system, and finding that switch, as they say, from just growth to suddenly going off and proliferating into other parts of the body. Is some of the work that you're doing involved with that metastatic switch?
Yes, it is. And we do assays to look to see if any of our drugs that we're developing block metastasis. And we've seen that this is true with our SAD1 inhibitor. And as you said, Joyce, is that 95% of patients who die from cancer die from metastatic disease. That is, you may have breast cancer that starts in your breast, but it metastasizes to your lung or brain or liver, and that's why you die, is because it's, you know, taken over another organ and shut down a key organ that is absolutely necessary for life. And so if you were able to, and that's why early diagnosis is very important, and if you had drugs that not only inhibited cell proliferation but also inhibited metastasis, which is mechanistically very different from proliferation, you'd have very powerful drugs.
Mm-hmm. So most of the work that you've done up to this point, you mentioned that you've published something in most of the organ systems where there are hard tumors. It's all over the body. Are you seeing some similarities in the processing in different parts of the body? So what goes on in the lung is somehow related to what goes on in some other organ?
Well, the interesting things that have interrelationships are the genetic mutations or genes that these oncogenes that are turned on. So they're pathways, many pathways that are very common to all tumors, like mm-hmm. in kidney cancer, where we've got 13 to 14 drugs now approved. Some of these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, like sunitinib, which block these tyrosine kinase receptors, are altered in many other cancers, and so that's why you're seeing survival benefit of some of these tyrosine kinase inhibitors that block the VEGF receptor, the EGF receptor, and many other of these tyrosine kinase receptors, PDGF receptor. That's why mm-hmm. you're seeing that these same drugs can be used in patients with other cancers, because those same pathways are mutated, and it's very often it's not just one signaling pathway that's mutated, it's many pathways. We've done this genomic profiling of patient kidney cancer tumors, and we just took, there are thousands of genes that are messed up, and that's why we haven't cured cancer. And we just took the top 200 genes that were commonly overexpressed in clear cell kidney cancer, and we now have technologies that we can silence genes individually. And so we took 6 human kidney cancer cell lines and individually silenced these 200 genes. And out of those 200 genes, we identified 31 of those genes that were important to regulating and promoting cell proliferation. Some of those genes also promoted invasion and metastasis. And that's originally where we discovered SCD1 and started pursuing, started specifically pursuing that, understanding how that gene signaled and whether we could develop therapies against it.
It's not just one thing that goes wrong. It turns on a sort of waterfall of effect. So as the tumor progresses, more and more things get changed in weird and awful ways.
Yes, ma'am. So absolutely. As you said, as the tumor becomes more aggressive, there are more genetic mutations, and there are also potentially other epigenetic mutations where gene expression of a gene at a normal level gets highly expressed, and now it's on all the time. Even it may not be mutated, but it's on. It's highly elevated, and it's causing tumor cells to either proliferate or metastasize, or to be drug resistant. Drug resistance, and so you've got not one or two or three or four genes. You've got a large number of genes that are altered from that of normal cells.
Hmm.
That's why you can.
And because of the seed of proliferation, which you mentioned earlier, if one cell successfully mutates to resist the drug, that will be the cell that starts replicating like crazy because other cells are dying off. And so
Correct. Pretty
soon you have a very resistant tumor.
Correct. And also this idea of tumor heterogeneity, that is, you can have multiple tumor cells with different mutations. And so you could say identify, a cell that's a cell population that is highly responsive to Sutent, where it's targeting, say, the PDGF receptor. You can kill off those cells, but now you've got potentially another subset of cells that may have another mutation that's not responsive, and so those cells continue to grow and to expand. And so you've killed part of your tumor, but not the whole tumor, because you've got this tumor heterogeneity with different mutations, and even though it's kidney cancer, they've got, different cells have different mutations in them.
Yeah, I heard a researcher say once that kidney cancer is so varied that it's quite possible that every kidney cancer is its own kind of cancer, which is pretty amazing.
That is. And, it's spawned this concept that we call individualized or personalized medicine, where we now that we've sequenced the whole human genome, we can actually analyze each patient's tumor and determine what those genetic mutations are or epigenetic alterations are that potentially we could personalize combination therapies, and that's the idea of what my laboratory is based upon, is that tumor mutations that are driving the cancer biology can be targeted in combination with combination therapies to either kill the tumor or to make it indolent, that allows a person to live a normal lifespan.
Speaking of combinations, why is it that the immunotherapy drugs that we have now, the immune checkpoint blockers, all seem to work so much better when they're combined with almost anything else? The limiting factor just seems to be the toxicity of the combination.
The immune checkpoint inhibitors, if I can kind of explain what they are, first of all, T cells have a protein on the cell membrane called PD-1, and that PD-1 will recognize another protein called PD-L1, and if it does, it blocks the ability of the T cells to kill the tumor. So if a T cell has an antigen on it that recognizes the tumor cells very often have the ability to make PD-L1 and put it on their cell surface to protect them from T cells. Pretty clever mechanism by tumor cells. And so the way these immune checkpoint inhibitors work, they're essentially antibodies that bind to either PD-1 or PD-1, like Keytruda, which binds to PD-1, and so the antibodies binds to it, and now the T cell is free to kill the tumor cell. So in patients that rely on that PD-L1, then single agent Keytruda can actually cure a patient if the T cells recognize the tumor cells and can kill them. Okay?
Right.
So adding additional therapy like your boy enhances the immunogenicity of the T cells to recognize and potentially kill the tumor cell. And some of these other chemotherapies which cause cell death, well, what's potentially happening is you are now getting protein fragments that the immune system see as foreign. And so now you've got the immune system, like macrophages, seeing these foreign proteins and creating and arming T cells against these, quote, foreign proteins. And so now you're activating the immune system, and that this may be the mechanism by where chemotherapies and other therapies combined with the immune checkpoint inhibitors are enhancing the immunogenicity and the ability of the immune checkpoint inhibitors to enhance T cell killing of the tumor. Did that make sense, or was it too many words?
It does. But what do you think about the addition of tyrosine kinases to the immune checkpoint blockers? We're seeing some fantastic response rates combining atezolizumab with axitinib, for example. And the targeted therapies, the tyrosine kinases, are really interesting because they don't directly kill cancer cells. They just prevent them from being able to thrive.
Right. Typically, they're cytotoxic. I don't quite understand the mechanism of action of that. Interestingly, our SCD1 inhibitor enhances immune checkpoint inhibitors too. But our compound has the ability to induce cell death or apoptosis. That's sort of our working hypothesis that we haven't proven yet, but we think that it's enhancing the ability of to activate immunogenic T cells, these killer T cells.
Well, there definitely are going to be some very exciting clinical trials coming up in the future with these new drugs.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what's so exciting right now is that, you know, the pace of discovery. As long as we can, you know, keep our funding, you know, in place, and the pace of we have the technologies to make the discoveries. You need three things: technologies, funding, and bright minds to make the discoveries. And we are, you know, on the brink of incredible discoveries that will truly lead to cures. I used to not believe that you could cure cancers, but I do now.
That's right.
Because you have the ability to kill cells or even potentially revert the cell from a tumor cell back towards a normal cell. Cells are truly plastic in nature that they can go back and forth. Yeah, think about it. I mean, are you...
That's
go ahead, Mike.
Mike, go.
You mentioned bright minds. And one of the things that is in your biographical statement at Mayo is that you were instrumental in founding the SPARC Research Mentorship Program at Mayo Clinic. And tell us a little bit about how that science program for the advancement of research knowledge has come about and what that does for young minds that's interested in getting involved in research.
Right. Well, I had a great experience about 12 years ago with two twin brothers who were high school students who called me up and said, said they wanted to cure melanoma with tea extracts. And I said, well, that might not work, but would love to have you in the lab. And you know, these two brothers, one wanted to be a lawyer and the other had always wanted to be a physician. And you know, they basically entered the science fair and went all the way to the International Science and Engineering Fair and won two big prizes, and this made an incredible difference in their lives. And you know, they stayed engaged and with research. They came back and worked in the summer as college students in the laboratory, and they both went on to medical school and are now physicians. So clearly, you know, one of the brothers, you know, clearly changed his career path. And both of them are not only physicians, but remain engaged in research to make discoveries. And so 3 years ago, we were finally able to start a program here. And Sharon Collins, who was our program director, was very instrumental in setting the program up here at Mayo Clinic. So we now we're in our third year of sponsoring students who can come into the labs over the summer and do a science fair project.
Do you need to take a break and get something to drink? Because we're going to edit the little things out. Feel free to do that.
Okay. Let me grab some water real quick. So in 2017, we started off with 9 students, and one of those students went on to the International Science and Engineering Fair and won 3rd place, and we're in our, you know, finishing up our 2nd year right now with 16 students, and we've just, in our 3rd year, we had over 70 applications from St. John's County and Duval County. So we have 2 counties that are right next door to one another. And we have 30 students accepted who are coming this summer.
Now, they'll not only work in your lab, but they'll work in the other labs too, won't they?
Exactly.
There are several labs
at
Mayo they'll be collaborating with.
Right. And importantly, you know, the faculty, we have 19 faculty volunteering this year, some, of course, taking more than one student. And what's important is these faculty members are volunteering their time and their dime to help mentor these young minds and potentially influence and change their career paths and their lives. So
the guys didn't cure melanoma with their tea, but they really got involved, and it got you guys started into doing something that's really helping out.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
And that sort of out-of-the-box thinking is so important in science.
It absolutely is, and it comes back to this idea of, you know, really bringing bright minds into science and making key discoveries that can change the world.
I heard some doctors talking the other day about how we're almost changing the paradigm from thinking about cancer as an organ-specific kind of disease. This is breast cancer, that's lung cancer, this is kidney cancer. And to working instead on these pathways, as you say, that may affect more than one organ system, but that in terms of what drug you apply, it needs that particular drug to target that particular mechanism.
Correct. So like, you know, BRCA1 and BRCA2 are, you know, well known to be mutations, if diagnosed as a germline mutation in women, that, you know, they're going to have a 70 to 80% chance of getting breast cancer. But BRCA1 and 2 mutations are found in other cancers as well at a low incidence rate. But it's important to recognize that. And so patients with prostate cancer and bladder cancer and pancreatic cancer have these BRCA1 mutations as well. And if you've picked this up from, you know, genomic profiling, you know, there are companies out there that, you know, commercially do this all the time now, and our faculty members and oncologists can, you know, use the, you know, we do that on a routine basis here now. And so we can tell a patient what their mutation status is of their tumor, and it may help truly guide successful life prolonging therapy for them. So we, you know, we now have these what we call PARP inhibitors, you know, that can treat, you know, BRCA1 and 2 mutations in cancers, and they're showing clear survival benefit in clinical trials right now in ovarian cancer.
Fabulous.
So Robin, we've got a guy that is involved in research, and he now believes that cancer is curable. You got any closing thoughts about that?
That's a very exciting thought. And I know people have always talked about the cure for cancer. I think today we're understanding it won't be the cure, but there will be lots of cures.
You're absolutely right, Robin. And it's going back to this idea of this oncogenomics, knowing that many, many genes are mutated in each cancer, and just about each individual's cancers are individualized and different. And so we have to understand that makeup and begin targeting those oncogenic pathways.
Yes, and sometimes patients, for example, a patient with lung cancer turns out to have a genetic mutation that makes him respond to a drug that nobody would have ever suspected or used for that kind of cancer before.
Yep.
So it's really an exciting time.
Joyce, you got any final thoughts?
Yes, thank you so much for the very exciting work that you're doing. And it occurs to me that just as in my lifetime we've seen the progression of computers from like almost non-existent to now you have a cell phone in your hand that has more power than the computers that took the people to the moon. So,
right.
And I think we're going to see that same incredible evolution of medical genomics in the lifetime of the people who are just now beginning their careers. So it's very exciting to see this, and I encourage you to do this, and I especially admire the work that you're doing to develop that next generation of bright minds. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Joyce.
Al, you got any summation thoughts? I have really enjoyed having you with us today, sir. You're an inspiration to a lot of people.
Well, thank you, Michael. I would encourage patients to, you know, to own their own cancer and to really be very proactive in understanding their cancer at the genetic level and really become familiar with the therapies and clinical trials and novel therapies that are out there. And, you know, there are cutting-edge technologies that are going to change the way we're being treated, and new discoveries are being made all the time. So it really is important to really be intellectually engaged and to you know, to fight for your survival.
Thank you very much. That's a very good point, and we appreciate you making that clear to our many listeners out there. Al, we have enjoyed having you with us. We've been talking to Al Copeland of the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, and we appreciate him taking time out of his schedule to be with us today. Join us again for our next edition of Powerful Patient, where we'll have someone else with exciting information to share for you so that you can be a powerful patient.